No, I mean, we definitely have similarities. I got a job and he doesn't. He knows that.
Wow, Steve Belichick cutting loose a little bit. Risking the ire of the old man. The old man's going to blow up his phone and
it's going to take him out of the will.
Yeah, that's the thing. I would not mess around. Anytime you've got multiple siblings and you've got one really rich parent, you better be careful because there's no guarantee that it's being divided equally among the children. I don't have that leverage against my child because there's only one.
Right.
But I'm kind of thinking, boy, it really would be nice to play one against the other.
Wow, you would
progressively
think that.
Oh, I would. I have never thought about it before because I haven't had the occasion to do so.
Let me manipulate my kids through my will. That's right.
Damn straight.
I think Bill's got
it's
so
one of
much
the benefits
money.
Of having money.
It doesn't matter what percentage you get. You know, Bill. I mean, he's
don't have to get many of it.
He's cut him out. He could cut him out, but I don't think
give it
you
to
know,
your dogs.
The Belichick family
give
or the
to
kids
that
are
dog.
Gonna be hurting for cash, right? I mean, you know, we always hear like how much the quarterbacks have, right? The all time earners at the quarterback position, right? All that. I mean, it would be interesting to know what Bill Belichick made throughout his career, right? I mean, it's you got to think he's sitting on a big pile for sure. And we don't know exactly what he got paid all those years. But either way, good for Steven Belichick up there at Washington.
I'd say the over-under on his career earnings is probably $245 million.
Okay.
That's the over-under.
Okay. I was going to say, I mean, it's over $200 million, right? I mean, you got to figure the last 10 to 12 years – we're talking about, you know, clearly, astronomically being paid like the highest paid coach in football, right?
Yes.
I mean, those are the rumors I heard. I never heard exact numbers. I kind of know exact numbers towards the end of his career, or at least close to it, I think, right? I mean, I think
25.
I'm in the ballpark, right? I'm in the ballpark, right? But, yeah, I had no idea what he was making 10, 12 years ago. And, of course, he was in his prime then, and they were the greatest team we've seen in the history of football. But, yeah, so you say 245. That's your number there.
Yeah, because I don't know how many years he was making 20 to 25.
I know.
Maybe the last five, 6 years.
Right.
Because they do a good job of holding it down. They do a good job. I've said this before. Would you rather pay, you know, a mid-level starting quarterback $30 million a year?
Yeah, right.
Or would you rather pay that to a great coach who's going to change everything? Without a union, they have not been able to grow coaching salary the same way that they would grow player salary, and that's been a reality for
a
while.
But the good
now,
ones are getting taken care of in different ways or whatever else.
Well, that's right.
Right.
And that's a way that they do it so they don't blow the curve for everybody else.
Right.
You pay them through other companies. It's not off the books in that Uncle Sam doesn't get his piece because Uncle Sam always does get his piece or your ass is going to jail. It's just not reflected on whatever official documentation
the
league has.
Right.
And so you don't have a rising tide lift all boats. It's kind of bogus for a head coach to go along with that because he's got to be smart enough to know it's screwing the guys who are just getting in. And I guess if the choice is we do it this way or we don't do it at all, okay, fine. I'll let somebody else stand on principle. I want to sit on my big stack of cash. So, but there is no requirement that anyone give anything to their children. You can disinherit all of them. He could give it to his dog that took over the draft 4 years ago if he wanted to. Remember Leona Helmsley?
Yeah.
She gave all of her money to her cats.
I live down the street from that house. I see it every day, that house. It's the most beautiful house in the world. And I just go, gosh, what was that woman thinking? Not paying taxes. And yeah, what'd she do? $10 or $15 million for the dog, right? Or was it 20? It might have been north of 20.
Dog or cat, I don't know.
Yeah, it was a dog.
So is the dog driving around to Bentley?
No. I think they've sold the house. They couldn't sell it forever, right? I mean, it's a beautiful, great Gatsby-type looking castle, right? That's what the Leona Helmsley thing is. And it's on an incredible piece of property. It's probably about a half a mile down the road from me, and I just went black. And am I there? Are you hearing me still? Am I there? Okay.
I hear you, but you hear I don't me. See you. Okay. I guess it's just me for now. Okay. I hear you.
So I can talk still.
Everybody else does too.
But yeah, so I don't know. I think the dog's dead.
Not.
Okay, fine. Screw you then. But I think the dog's
we
dead.
We have the information.
All right.
We have the information. They're working on bringing you back. The dog will not be coming back. They have yet to figure out how to reanimate canines. However, I am told that when Leona Helmsley died, she left her pet Maltese named Trouble.
12.
A trust fund valued at $12 million. That made Trouble the third wealthiest dog in the world at the time. The top spot goes to Gunther III, who was Countess Carlotta Liebenstein, her German shepherd,
right,
who inherited $106 million in 1992.
Man.
That's a rich dog.
That's a rich dog. That's a baller dog.
That's a dog you want to suck up to. That's a dog. That's a dog that never has to sniff another butt again. That's how rich that dog.
Or maybe he gets to sniff a lot of them. Maybe that's what he wants for $106 million.
I don't know.
He might be like, wait, I want more butts to sniff. Come on. I mean, you don't know. You know, I know. You know, you're smart, but you have a bit of dog, so you're not sure about that one.
I don't know. I don't know if it's something they have to do or something they want to do. I really don't know why they do it. But we all know that. They do it. Other thing about Belichick.
Yeah.
Andrew Marchand, now of The Athletic, reported, and it was kind of tucked into a story about where Jason Kelce might end up, but Belichick reportedly telling the networks he's disinclined to appear on a regular studio show.
Right.
But he might do something with, like, Peyton Manning's Omaha Productions or maybe NFL Films. I don't know if it would be, you know, a periodic film study show or something. Whatever he does, though, he really needs to take into account the fact that right now you're going to have a hard time finding a fan base that gets fired up about bringing in Bill Belichick as the head coach. So you got some rehab to do. You got 20-plus years of crusty press conference, standoffish, rude at times that has to be undone.
Yeah.
And you better find a way
right.
to let people see that side of you
yep.
that everybody makes excuses for him. And I don't like the idea of people making excuses for adults. Like, I think we all need to be sufficiently self-aware as to whether or not we're acting in a way that is going to be good or bad for our long-term interests. And if you're acting like a complete jerk, you don't need your friends to say, he's like that all the time. It's like, well, why are you his friend then if he's like that all the time? Or, you know, he's only like that in this setting. Get him away from this setting, and he's a great guy. He's the life of the party. It's well, okay, but I never see that.
Yeah,
and if you're going to get fans out there to say, we want Bill when it's time to hire a new coach, Bill had better do some work this year to make those fans say, we want Bill.
Yeah, no, I don't disagree with that. I mean, we talked about that, right? He's, you know, the way he treated the media and has acted in front of the microphone, he's done himself no favors. Right. Nobody was sticking up for him. Maybe the way you would hear a lot of big time coaches towards the end of their career, bad spot, right, coming to an end. Yeah, I think, you know, he burned a lot of bridges that way where people weren't going to give him the benefit of the doubt. So I'm with you there. I do think, though, going on TV, doing some of that stuff, like we saw with the, you know, 100th year anniversary and the NFL Network and the stuff he did with Collinsworth about the top 100 players of all time. He is one of those guys, right, where I think, you know, you get him in the setting and he can maybe reinvigorate a fan base a little bit or get them to go because he's so smart. He's going to say things that a lot of us aren't going to think about when we think about a certain football situation or he breaks it down. And I think it's if people get to consistently see that and then, hey, he cracks a smile. He's a little bit more like the Belichick we saw early days in New England. You know, then maybe he can rehabilitate a little bit. I mean, I'm with you. But, Mike, you know, here's my reasoning of why I think a lot of people, you know, like you said, sweep it under the rug. He acts like this. Because I think everybody, one, was enamored, amazed about this amazing quality this guy had of being able to just shut out life and really be about, like, X's and O's, pulling guard, three technique, cover two, Tampa two, like just all it was. It was like the mad scientist. And I think a lot of people did make, you know, maybe excuses or tried to help him out in that department because they've never seen anybody kind of go all in and immerse themselves to the way, you know, I even witnessed Bill Belichick for a year and a half. And I'm sure, you know, of course, a lot of others there that just that's, I think, probably the reason they stick up for him there.
Well, and look, part of it, too, and I'm not making an excuse for him.
No.
By saying this, I'm just trying to understand how he became who he is.
Yeah.
When you consider how he was raised on the campus of the Naval Academy,
that's right.
His dad, an ultra old school coach and scout, gruff, do it this way, no excuses, no crybabies, you know, that Bill Parcells attitude, who was his mentor. You take the double whammy of his dad and his mentor
exactly.
in the sport.
Right.
And you get warped into thinking this is the way I'm supposed to be. This is the way it's supposed to go. You're not their friend. You don't get too close to them because you're going to have to cut them at some point. You are the coach, and you are there to get the most out of them. And even if that means being a jerk to them, if that's what it takes to get the most out of them, so be it. Hell, when I played football, it's going to be 50 years ago, when I started playing in grade school, Catholic grade school, the coach talked about it before. One of the reasons I worked so hard is when I was 10, 11 years old, if you're standing around on the practice field, the coach would literally kick your ass, literally shoo into your ass. If you're standing in the wrong place and you act like you don't know what you're doing, grab the face mask and drag you by the face mask to where you're supposed to go. Now, obviously, that would not work in today's world for a variety of reasons. And it's kind of surprising that they allowed it to happen back in the 70s. And I think eventually there was a parental uprising and that coach made his perhaps not so graceful exit. But that's the way it was. And
that's what he grew up.
It was a tougher, harder.
Right.
No excuses, no yeah. fun. Remember the Titans? Remember the Titans?
Sure.
Zero fun, sir.
Right.
Yeah. Football's fun. Right? Play football's fun. It's not fun. Football isn't fun.
Yes.
That's the mindset.
It is. Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. Zero fun,
no,
sir.
You're right, Mike. And add to that too, Mike. This is where, you know, again, I know you appreciate and respect Bill Belichick, right? But, you know, to a point you make all the time about, hey, you win, you got to immerse yourself. You know, you're at the top of the mountain. People are going to keep coming at you. And to do that, you got to be all in and all about it all the time and live it, right? We talk about that all the time. Well, I think Belichick, more than anyone, did that. And I think that's where people around him found that respect, because I think he won a two or three Super Bowls. Those first three Super Bowls, he had a little personality and charisma. But somewhere he got immersed into, wait, we got to stay on the mountaintop. We're going to be the greatest. I'm going to be the greatest. And it started to, yeah, sacrifice a smile and a little personality every now and then, because it just continued to go down a wormhole of film watching, dissecting. All I do is think about this. I mean, it's unlike any other human we've seen in the history of the NFL. I think that's what the public doesn't realize about Bill Belichick. I think that's why some of the ex-players are mad about the dynasty a little as well. It's never ends, right? It's the story of, like, remember the old special... Oh, excuse me, I'm drooling at myself. Special teams coach Scotty O'Brien, remember him back in the day? I mean, the story, they win the Super Bowl. I think it's the Seahawks Super Bowl. They're on the plane ride back. Scotty O'Brien had been talking about retiring and all that. I mean, it's the Super Bowl plane ride home, and he's going to have a little meeting on the plane and wants to get it done and figure it out, and how many days till you officially tell me, and all this type of stuff. It never ends. It's the day after the Super Bowl, and he is thinking about football and how he's going to win the next one the very next day. And that's where he's incredible. But somewhere in there, he became a curmudgeon, and more of a curmudgeon as the years went on as he got older. So I don't know where he kind of lost his smile that we used to see more and more in the old days.
It really is amazing to think that he's responsible for the organizational reset button, and he pressed it every year. And he was always that way. Never wanted to talk about last season.
Right.
We forget about last season. We move on to this season.
Right.
And that's what you need to do, because it's easy to get, and the word's not really complacent, because you've already achieved at a high level. Nobody who's achieved at that level could ever be called complacent, but you get satisfied. I guess that's the better word.
Right.
And you don't realize that you get thrown back into the fray with everyone else, and you're the measuring stick. You're the team they're trying to be.
That's right.
You're the team
Other
that they
competitive
can't wait
psycho
to see
coaches, right?
Yeah. Fall apart.
Right.
Right. Everybody's gunning for you. 31 other franchises gunning for you. Everything you do, every step of the way you go. I mean, think about it. Their run of greatness came at the largest the NFL has ever been. There were 31 teams the year they won their first Super Bowl. The Texans enter in 2002. They're dealing with 32 teams. Not that it was easy in the 70s, but you're only dealing with 26 teams when it's the Dolphins and the Steelers and the Raiders and the Cowboys running the league. In 76, I believe, 76, possibly 77, but I think it's 76. That's when the Seahawks and the Panthers arrived. I'm pretty sure it's 76.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure it's 76,
but
right.
32 teams. So 31 others who would love to see you fail. All those fan bases would love to see you fail. And you keep thriving, and you continue to be competitive. It's not like they had a year where the wheels came off. Their second year, they missed the playoffs.
By one
2008,
game.
Right. Even though they went 11-5,
yeah.
They missed the playoffs.
Right.
They made them every other year.
Yes.
Every other year until after Tom Brady left.
Right. No, it's an incredible run. And, you know, I know Belichick is tough and all that, but, you know, hopefully you know, as time goes on, we'll hear more and more positive stories. He's amazing. Again, I can't tell you how many people through the years, great coaches, players, whatever, right? You always hear the stories. They've been around the league. They've been around other great coaches. They go spend a day with Belichick, or they're just signed with the team and it's the first week, and they come out of that first week or a few days of being around it, shaking their head like, I've never seen anything like it. I've never seen anything like him. I've never seen anything the way he dissects. I mean, that's where he's a savant. He is. He's the greatest coach in the history of sports, in my opinion. It fell badly, and now he's got to rehabilitate, like you said. And good for Steven Belichick. He's a really damn good defensive coach, and now he gets a chance to prove, like, hey, I am good. It's not just my dad. He's not helping me out. I can do this too. So, you know, excited for his opportunity, and we'll see where it goes with Big Belichick.
After the wild card round of the playoffs, during which the Cowboys were embarrassed at home and the Eagles were embarrassed in Tampa Bay,
yeah.
There were a couple of days where there was a high degree of speculation and wonder as to whether or not one of those two teams, Philadelphia or Dallas, would fire their head coach and hire Bill Belichick. And because Jerry Jones has spoken so openly about potentially hiring Bill Belichick in the future, that came after the announcement from the Cowboys that Mike McCarthy would be back. There's a vibe out there, and I don't know if you've picked up on this. There's a vibe out there that Nick Sirianni came a lot closer to getting fired than Mike McCarthy.
Right.
And the Eagles didn't say anything. From the Eagles' perspective, a functional organization doesn't need to announce that a successful coach is coming back. But that doesn't mean they didn't seriously look at
it. Right, right.
What I mean, remember the Jeffrey Lurie face from the luxury suite
in
the fourth quarter?
Right.
This complicated mask of bewilderment, confusion, and just friggin' pissed off. Like, he was beside himself. I'd never seen him look that way. You don't make that go away unless you got a damn good plan. And I remember that when Nick Sirianni had, I think it was his post-game press conference, because remember they delayed like a week? There it is. Can I just get the hell out of here? What am I doing here? Why did I buy this team? Will this camera please get off me? What can I do? I need to go to the bathroom to just get out of here. Anyway, when Sirianni did his post-game press conference, they asked him, what are you going to do to turn this around? And he's spouting around coach speak, confidence. I have confidence. I remember thinking, you better have more than the word confidence if you're going to convince Jeffrey Lurie to keep you around for another year. Because that's how, remember, Doug Peterson.
Yeah.
They had that conversation after the year they didn't make it to the playoffs. The guy won the Super Bowl. And Jeffrey Lurie didn't like what he had to hear from Doug Peterson about making things better. And that was it. He was gone. So, Chris, I don't know if you heard the same thing I heard, but it's like, yeah, Sirianni was a lot closer to getting run out the door, in large part because Jerry Jones doesn't want to have to pay anybody to not coach, so he wasn't firing Mike McCarthy no matter what.
Yeah, I no doubt, like, Sirianni definitely went through some dicey times there in Philadelphia. Been led to believe the same type of thing, right? Yeah, it was a monumental collapse. Like, I think on the surface level, you're like, wait, you can't, you know, fire the guy who just went to the Super Bowl two seasons ago. But I think when you get into the context and dig into the situation, right, and I think a lot did go back to the head coach, and of course he's in control of controlling the players, the locker room, right? You have the, wait, guys are just going to change plays at the end of a football game on the head coach in a Monday night game in Seattle, right? That's rare, right? You think Tom Brady ever did that with Bill Belichick? Like, absolutely not. So that those things, but then again, I think it's the, wow, wait, not only did we fall apart and look horrible down the stretch, but we did that while also, again, let's be real, really having the best, most talented team in football. That's the, I think the, so where's the expectation level? Where's the level of going, wait, we're this good and we should be this at the very least? And I think they were so far below that and things were so messed up that, yeah, I got the sense and things we've heard Jeffrey Lurie say that there was real thought there a little bit about let's evaluate everything here, what went wrong. And I, and of course, think Sirianni was a big part of those conversations Lurie was having.
This week at the league meetings in Orlando, Jeffrey Lurie looking slightly happier, not that he could look any more unhappy than he did that Monday night in Tampa. Here he is explaining the decision to stick with Nick Sirianni for at least a fourth year.
The things with Nick, I have to say, were really impressive, were wanting to truly improve the ingredients of the offense, truly improve who was going to lead in terms of leading the offense and the direction it would go. Wanted to be much more innovative, much more dynamic. Of course, bring the things that brought us a lot of success, but very open to finding the best possible offensive coordinator, and the same with defensive coordinator. I mean, it's he's an offensive head coach more, but he recognized that Vic Fangio would be somebody that would be an outstanding defensive coordinator for us. I mean, we talked about his systems for years and all the people that, you know, he developed, and now we have the guy that really kind of fathered the certain approach to defense. And so Nick's conscious desire to have top-notch defense, top-notch coordinators under him really drove a lot of the strategy, and he was hell-bent on making sure we had the best.
And contrast that with the Doug Peterson firing. The impasse was over who the coordinators were going to be. So Sirianni had to be all in on bringing in the best. Now, reasonable minds may differ on whether Kellen Moore qualifies for that category.
Right.
He's been fired each of the
last
2 years.
He's an improvement. That's for sure. I'll say that.
An improvement.
Right.
Definitely an improvement.
Right.
And Vic Fangio is the guy they wanted last year and the guy they probably would have hired last year if the Cardinals hadn't tampered with Jonathan Gannon to the point where the Cardinals knew they were hiring him. The Eagles got caught flat-footed, and by the time they recognized they needed a new defensive coordinator, Vic Fangio had already given his word to Miami. So now they get Fangio a year later. That's the guy that he would have hired last year. The defense was not good last year between Sean Desai, who was soft-fired halfway through the season for Matt Patricia, and now you've got Vic Fangio to come in and do his thing. That's the thing that saved Nick Sirianni. It might not save him for more than a year.
No.
I mean, it's hard to imagine a guy being on the hot seat after three seasons, a Super Bowl appearance, and playoffs every year. Playoffs every year. Unbelievable.
Yeah.
But that's where we are because Bill Belichick is looming, and I think the Eagles are one of the teams. Not that the fan base is going to be going nuts for Bill Belichick, but I think the fan base would not revolt either. They'd be willing to give it a try if Jeffrey Lurie and Howie Roseman think that's the right thing to do.
Well, it's like the old, you know, sometimes you hear me say, right, like the old saying with quarterbacks, like, are you taking advantage of all that's there to be had, right? You know, if there's a 20-yard in-cut open, are you throwing that, right? And, you know, but you know, some of these grading sites, they'll he checked it down for a 3-yard gain and he gets a positive grade. It's like, no. You know, like, you know, somebody was open for 30 yards over the middle. We let that go. Why? I don't know. We didn't maximize the play. I think a little bit that with the coach, going back to kind of what I said a few minutes ago, right? It's like you said, when you read off the resume, you go, ooh, that sounds really good. But the fact of the matter is they want more than that. Lurie expects more than that. Howie Roseman expects more than that. We, of course, expect more than that in what we saw the Eagles. Listen, you don't need to be a brilliant Bill Belichick mind to look at the Eagles and go, huh, best offensive line in football. Huh, best defensive line in football. Huh, pretty good corners. Maybe the best duo of receivers in football, like we talk about. Damn good quarterback, right? So I think there's a little bit of Lurie and Howie Roseman probably like, we're awesome, and we're getting dominated by Baker Mayfield and the Bucks in the wild card game, like with an all-star team. So I think that's where they had to go back to it. But obviously, Jeffrey Lurie thought about this in depth, right? I like that about him. He's a guy and one of those owners, Mike, we talk about where, you know, he meddles, but he's all in all the time. He's all over everything. So he's a little different. He's more Jerry Jones than the normal owner, right? I think that's what people don't realize either. And I got to think the coordinator stuff, like you talked about, had to go play into the decision of going, man, that was tough. I mean, yeah, we did lose Shane Steichen. The Gannon thing with Fangio and all that was a little odd and weird as well. So the fact that Sirianni was willing to be progressive and get some other big personalities back in the building at the coordinator position, I'm sure, you know, Lurie liked that. That was still, you know, he was still looking to go forward and be constructive going forward and cutting edge and doing all that. And hopefully they can take advantage of that and the new coordinators there in Philadelphia.
You made a point that a lot of fans just don't realize, that Jeffrey Lurie does have a spoon in the stew.
Yeah.
Does it in
right.
a low-key way.
Right.
And it's one of the reasons why Howie Roseman has survived as long as he has, because Howie lets him. You know, there's a chance you hire a GM who, although he would not be dumb enough to come out and say, can you please get out of my face? I have a job to
right.
do. Guy who signs my checks. You get a vibe when you're not really welcome in a setting like that. And that vibe could emanate from plenty of general managers who don't want to
yeah.
allow the owner to be essentially, as they would say at a university, GM emeritus. Because
yeah,
that's
right.
kind of what he is.
Yeah.
He's not doing it full time, but he's all in and he's smart about it. And he's not looking for the credit because he's I mean, and look, that's why I've always respected the Jerry Jones approach. He's not making any bones about it.
Yeah.
I'm the GM.
Yeah.
And a lot of these owners, people don't realize, a lot of these owners are basically the GM. They just don't want to know they're the GM because they don't want to take the heat for it.
Yeah.
That's why they pay the commissioner so much. They don't want to take the heat for the things that they want to do, so the commissioner is the one who takes the heat. Within each organization, the GM is the one who takes the heat, and the GM is the one who gets fired for going along with the things the owner wants to do.
Yeah. No, I think that's a big part of it. And, you know, that's where – you know, credit to Jeffrey Lurie and having the right touch in that type of situation. Credit to Howie Roseman, and from what I've heard, yeah, they've welcomed him, right? Talking to people that have been in the front office, it's kind of like, hey, Lurie, come in. Hey, we'll teach you. Look, this is what we're looking at. What do you think? This guy, that guy. See, we like this. So they've embraced it instead of like you're talking about, kind of like, ugh. Here's the owner. Yeah, good to see you, owner. Right, great. Yeah, yeah, yeah. We like that player too. Right, yeah. Oh, yeah. He's awesome. Right.
Looking at your
yeah,
watch.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, so yeah, that's yeah. where I think it is a different dynamic to your point there. It is. And that's why the Eagles are a top-notch organization. And we see that, right? I mean, Lurie's not afraid to make tough decisions, whether it's fire Doug Peterson or a tough decision where a lot of the Eagles fan base was going, fire Nick Sirianni, do that. And he evaluated it, let things calm down and went, you know, hey, it wasn't his best year, but there's still been a lot of good here. And there were some things that worked against him, and I still believe in him. And he reassessed, and he's going to move forward with him. And we'll see where it goes. But I think it's the right decision, certainly. I do. And we'll see how well they can capitalize this year.
And a gutsy move because Belichick was available.
Yeah,
we
right.
don't know what conversations happened back channels, but we know those conversations happen. Due diligence gets done all the time without the prying eyes, the media even being aware of it. But you got the Cowboys, who could maybe hire Belichick next year when Mike McCarthy's contract expires. And what have they really done to make the team better this year? Does anybody really think the Cowboys are going to be as good, much less better than they were last year based upon what they've done so far this offseason? A lot can still change, but it's not looking
like
they are
that. Right.
All in.
Right.
all in. I mean, it's amazing how all in has become such a joke, but Jerry's the one who made it the joke.
Yeah.
By saying it over and over and over again and not doing anything remotely resembling all in. So you got the Cowboys, you got the possibility for the Eagles if this doesn't work with Sirianni this year. And then you got the Giants, kind of the low key, you know, they're the team that's been firing their coach every other year. Daboll is the first one to get a third year since Tom Coughlin, for crying out loud. They were doing lather, rinse, repeat over and over and over again. Out they go. In they come. Out they go. Here's John Mara. Well, no, we already talked about John Mara saying that Brian Daboll needs to tone it down. Here is Daboll from earlier this week on John Mara saying that the third-year head coach needs to tone down his demeanor.
Yeah, look, I talk to John every day. I talk to my staff every day. Like every year, there's a self-evaluation process that goes on, whether I was a position coach, a coordinator, in this case, a head coach. You know, I'm a very passionate person, but yeah, there's times where I wish I handled things a little bit differently, certainly. So you continue to grow, you continue to evolve.
Yeah, I mean, look, it is difficult because you do get into it.
Yeah,
you do.
And he's got fire.
To win,
right? He's got fire.
Yeah. Well, but it's funny. Speaking of fire, like, yeah. And I don't know that technically guys were fired, but every assistant coach that he got into it with,
yeah,
in the public eye this year got fired.
Right.
Special teams coordinator. Oh, they downplayed it in the preseason. Oh, it's just, you know, it's just guys being guys. I don't know. Whatever. The
Thomas McGowan.
And then he got it gets fired.
Right.
And then Wink Martindale, oh, it's no big deal. Oh, this is all made up. Oh, this is all embellished. And then he's gone. And was he fired? Was he not? It was so awkward at the end. So, yeah, that's part of what – when the owner says this is what you need to do, guess what? You better do it.
Right.
You better – when he says it publicly, because usually – and this is a sign of dysfunction with your New York football Giants.
Chris. How dare you? How dare you talk about my team like that? What are you doing here?
Let me just say this.
No, right.
John Mara never should say that publicly. Ever should say that publicly. That's something you handle behind closed doors with the coach. You don't embarrass him that way publicly. That is what a dysfunctional organization does.
Well, you know, I don't know. Listen, it's definitely a thing up here, I think. And I think it's a little more talked about in NFL circles maybe, you know, than people realize a little bit that way. Maybe Mara thinks that's the way to kind of get through to Daboll, right? I mean, maybe that's where it is. I don't know.
Only if you've tried it.
I know.
If you've tried it 100 times
and
it hasn't worked.
Right.
We've talked about that before with Aaron Rodgers.
Yes.
You only call your teammates out publicly if you've done everything else under your power, stopping short of embarrassing them publicly.
Now,
that's when you use that, that arrow.
I'm with you. Now, the Giants, right? They're an old school organization, right? I know we have the Patriot way, but like, you know, okay, for I don't have a phrase for it, but the Giants have their own way too of how they want, you know, their quarterback, their head coach to act, right? So I think that's where they were probably, you know, I don't know how to say, a little turned off, let's just say, by Daboll and some of the actions on the sidelines. Whether that is, hey, you're the head coach, it looks a little unstable when you're yelling at all your coaches all the time, or you're yelling at your starting quarterback in a big moment and basically letting us all know he messed up, he's the problem, and doing that on TV. And that, you know, not only are the Giants old school and don't like that, but you know, too, there's an unwritten code of conduct in the NFL to not show up your fellow coaches or players in the public eye, right? And I think Brian Daboll, Brian Daboll realizes he crossed that line a little bit last year, and he knows that the Maras and the Giants aren't about that, and that's probably why they're a little extra emphasis on that.
It's the same line that John Mara crossed. So that's the irony of it. He did the very thing that Daboll did. And maybe he's giving Daboll a taste of his own medicine. Maybe letting him see how it feels. I don't know. But I just think that's something that should have been handled privately. Not that we will complain about having content, because when those things aren't handled privately, it gets things to talk about.
I think this puts the ultimate pressure on it. I hear you there. I mean, it does give us a lot of the stuff to talk about. But I think this puts the ultimate pressure on it. And the Giants fan base, when they hear the owner say that, they go, well, I mean, hey, we all heard him say this. Now Daboll's got to act accordingly. It's out there. right? There's no like, ooh, did they have a conversation? Has this been there? I would guess that's John Mara's, you know, thought there. You know, I will say John Mara last year, what was his thing he said last year at the owners meeting? I don't want to go from, you know, Bono to Bobo or whatever, the clown, right? You know,
Bozo,
right? Whatever the hell it was.
Bobo.
I couldn't remember what the hell it was. I don't know. But yeah, either way, I mean, you know, he obviously, you know, even with that comment, saw things where he was like, hey, I want us to stay on the straight and narrow, right? Or whatever. So he's got a little feel for the team and the organization. And yeah, he's dealing with a little situation there with the head coach where he wants them to act a little bit more the giant way, let's say.
It really is unbelievable. Ben McAdoo with his giant suit lasted 2 years. Steve Spagnuolo was the interim coach at the end of that run.
Right.
Pat Shurmur lasted 2 years. Joe Judge lasted two
Oof,
years.
Man.
And Brian Daboll made it 2 years and now gets a third, and there's no guarantee that he'll get a fourth. And look, you got three teams in the NFC East that have plausible connections to Bill Belichick. And the Giants are the team. Remember when there was the public ugliness? It was the Seth Wickersham report that really delved into the Garoppolo, Brady,
yeah,
Belichick,
right,
craft. It was almost Shakespearean, and a lot of it was validated by the Dynasty series that, you know, they bring in Garoppolo as the guy who's eventually going to replace Tom Brady, and then Brady wants him out, and Kraft goes with Brady, and Belichick's new quarterback potentially is out the door. When all that blew up, Gary Myers suggested that Belichick wants to go coach the Giants. And Belichick won a couple of Super Bowls as the defensive coordinator of the Giants. So, and
that
I
was there. That was a real thing. I think there was that was real for a little bit. I do. I think there was a little bit of like, from both sides, I had heard this through the grapevine of the NFL and people I trust where, you know, I think there was a little bit of like, hey, with the Giants, they were like, yeah, you think Bill would, you know, leave New England and ever come to us? And I think there was a little bit on the other side, vice versa to that too, where Bill was like, hey, I like New England, but man, I love the Giants and I love that organization. And I think there was a little bit something in the back of his mind there, some truth there of like, maybe I should go and coach there to end my career. I think there was some real plausible stuff there behind all of that.
The problems were,
yeah,
I think, two, because I did some digging into it at the time. Number one, there was no way that Robert Kraft,
right,
was going to let him go to the Giants.
Yeah, no way. Of all teams, it wasn't the Giants.
They were not letting him go to the Giants. They had his contractual rights, and they were not letting him go. If he wants to quit, he can quit, but he can't coach for them. And the compensation would have been presumably astronomical at the time. And secondly, you know, I was told that, hey, to get everything to where Belichick likes it,
it's going to take
about 5 years.
Exactly right. Exactly.
So why do you want to do that? When you've already got everything where you like it,
right,
why do you want to go start from scratch in your late 60s and hope that you get the support you need and you get enough time to even get those 5 years? Now it's a different construct altogether. There's no compensation. There's nothing that Kraft can do to stop him from coaching the Giants. And anywhere he goes, he's starting from scratch. Anywhere he goes, he's got to do stuff. And you just got to wonder, and again, this is the back channel stuff we'll never know, but would it be crazy, Chris, to think that at some level there's communications going on and a wish list may have been communicated to somebody high up in the organization, not only the Giants. I'm saying this is the kind of thing, if you want to lure Belichick next year, you lay the foundation for it now.
Yeah, right.
What are the kind of things you like? Tell me what you like. And, you know, the unspoken part or the spoken part would be, we'll start putting together
the things that
you would like
in the event
that you come here.
Right, right. I don't doubt things like that can happen, will happen, or are already happening. Belichick, again, like we're talking about, he is like in the hierarchy of the NFL to a degree where, again, this is not like, oh, coach calls him or GM, like owners call Bill Belichick on the regular, right? I mean, throughout the league, we've heard the stories about the Giants calling Bill Belichick to ask him who they should hire as head coach. They are not the only team that has called Bill Belichick and goes, hey, what do you think we should do here? We kind of like this guy and that guy. He is kind of the godfather of football that way. So, like, those things that you're talking about, next level moves, chess moves, whatever, yeah, I wouldn't be shocked. We'll see where this goes. But, yeah, Bill is in a stratosphere in the NFL of going right above an agent or a GM or whatever, and it's like, hey, I got, you know, Lurie's phone number. Hey, how you doing? I got Jerry Jones' number, blah, blah, blah. Let's talk. And it's going to be exciting to see if he really wants to jump in after this year.
I'm trying to envision the conversation between John Mara and Steve Tisch, the two owners of the Giants, when somebody has the idea that they should call Bill Belichick and get his input on something. The next sentence is, well, I'm not going to call him. Here, you call him. Well, I'm not calling him. You call him. Speaking of calls, how about Brian Daboll talking also easy for him to say early this week about the possibility of taking over the offensive play calling. Here's what Daboll had to say about that.
Something that I'm looking into, talked to, I think there's 20 head coaches at this point in time that call plays in the league, which is on both. So I think it's 20. There might be a little bit more, but again, I've been doing a bunch of research, but no decision's been made. I'm still going through that process and, you know, thinking about what we need to do.
Oh, that's a bad sign for Mike Kafka. He's when you know the number, when you've already done that much research, I mean, you're actively thinking about it because you're aware of how many you're doing it. See, how many do, you know, should I do that? Let's see how many do this. Let's say, administrative assistant, can you put together a list for me of all the people who, oh, it's 20? Okay, thank you. I mean, so he's thinking about it, Chris. He's clearly thinking about it because he's talking about it. And that may be something that happens this year because he's smart enough to know. He's smart enough to know that Bill is looming over the entire division. And it's a question of which team is going to make the move. And to take it back to our original point about him not being inclined to take a regular studio show job and me saying, well, he needs to, you know, get a fan base behind him. Maybe he already has an idea where he's going to be next year, and he doesn't need,
to do that.
He's going to spend the year.
Right.
Remember when Mike McCarthy spent the whole year preparing for coming back? Maybe Bill's job this year is going to be doing everything he can to get ready to hit the ground sprinting wherever he goes next year, that he's confident he's going somewhere and he's spending all this year getting himself ready for
it. Yeah, well, I mean, listen, he's capable of all that, setting that up, you know, having a spot, and of course, you know, diving in, immersing himself with an organization and getting it to where, yeah, he could, you know, hit the ground sprinting, like you said. Like we said, it'll be interesting to see how he approaches it and where he goes there. But, you know, the Daboll thing, it's a big year for Brian Daboll. You know what I mean? You know that. I know that. We know that. Everybody knows that. It's one good year that exceeded expectations last year. Again, it was a tough schedule. There was injuries, all of that. But it still didn't have a great look, whether it's the arguing, you know, on the sideline with an org coordinator or yelling at Daniel Jones or the pass protection. It just didn't have a great look. That's games that were blown, right? You know, the Jet game, like, come on, the Jet game, they blew that football game. So that's where I think it leaves a bad taste in everybody's mouth. And that's where Daboll's smart enough to realize all that. He knows all that. And Mike, you know, you've heard me say this before. Again, he got the job because of what, Mike? Why did he get the job, right? Tell me why he got the job.
Proximity to Belichick.
Well, and the ability to call plays and come up with an offensive game plan.
True.
Right, I know. You went deeper into that than I expected.
Offensive, but that's a fundamental truth for any offensive coordinator who becomes a head coach. That's how you got the job.
Exactly.
That's why so many of them call the play.
That's you heard me during the year last year. I like Mike Kafka. I think he's got a bright future. It's not an indictment on him. I'm just saying, damn, Brian Daboll, you got a head coaching job, and you were awesome with Josh Allen and that Bills offense, and they were the best they were ever because of you and your ability to string plays together and feel a defense out and adjust and do all that. And to me, that's one of the great talents that he has to offer, and he's not offering that to the Giants football team. I would like to see that. I would. Again, you know, great offensive minds like we've talked about. I mean, you know, he's not at Andy Reid status yet where he's got things so groomed that, like, maybe coordinators are an extension of him and they know exactly what he's thinking, right? You know, I'd like to see him take the Shanahan, the McVay, the Mike McDaniel approach. You're an offensive genius. Be the offensive genius on Sunday, too. You know, I'm rooting for him. You know that. And that's just, you know, me trying to give words of advice or my two cents on the whole situation.
One last point, then we're going to do a draft of the coaches under the most pressure entering the 2024 season. The Giants had a private workout with Michigan quarterback J.J. McCarthy. Now, they're drafting six.
Right.
I don't think he's going to be there at six. They may have to move up to get him. But you know what? It's the kind of thing, and we've seen this happen before, it can give a potentially embattled GM and or head coach a little more time. It's only the most dysfunctional of dysfunctional teams will clear out the head coach and the GM 1 year after drafting a potential franchise quarterback. Now, some do, some have. I think the Bears did that. Didn't they do that after getting Fields, brought in a new regime?
Yeah.
One year after it,
right. Then they let go of Nagy. Yeah. And then they've been looking, here they're doing that kind of move right now, what you're talking about.
Yeah. So, anyway, that's something. Oh, it hasn't happened yet. It's going to happen on Easter Sunday. Easter Sunday. Come on. Can't you do it? You know, hey, that's no days off, as someone once said. So, anyway, that's that. And, again, they're going to have to move up if they want him because this may just be Jim Harbaugh trying to speak it into existence so he gets four quarterbacks off the board and gets the first pick in the draft. We talked about this earlier in the week. But, man, it just seems like McCarthy is the guy who, starting with Harbaugh saying he'll be the first pick in the draft, that like lit the fuse on him making it all the way close to the top and maybe all the way to number two.
Well, I think it did lit the fuse, and I think we're out of time here now where, you know, you alluded to this a few weeks ago. The important decision makers are starting to watch and dive into the film a little bit, and they're going, hey, front office, J.J. McCarthy is way better than you guys have him ranked or whatever. And they're starting to dive into it and realize, wait, his physical tools are there, let alone, oh, wait, if I'm a great offensive mind, right? And again, this is a skill, and not everybody has this. You know, Shanahan, right? There's a reason Shanahan and McVay like certain guys. I got 9 million plays and checks and rules, and I need a guy who can digest all of that and make it happen like a snap of his fingers on a Sunday afternoon at 1 p.m. No matter what, how loud the fans are, how bad, you know, big and bad that defensive line is, they can handle it. And I think that's what people see in J.J. McCarthy is leader, charismatic, right, better physical ability than people realize because of that offense in Michigan. He didn't get to show everything. And then I think he also go, ooh, he's humble. He's a team guy. And I think we could put a lot of offense on him. He knows football. And I think that's where offensive coordinators, quarterback coaches, head coaches are watching film going, this J.J. McCarthy's got something there.
Okay, coaches under the most pressure.
Ooh.
Heading into 2024. We usually do the draft later in the show. We're doing it right now. We're doing it live.
We're doing it live.
Give me your first pick.
I think my first is Robert Saleh for the New York Jets. I think that's where I would go. I think he's under the most pressure, right? I mean, again, you know, we talked about Daboll a little bit. The Jets, the way that all went down last year, it didn't look good. It became a little too much of a circus in the offseason, as we know, right? We've talked a little bit too much about the Jets, let's get control of the locker room, the leaks, right? You know, some people are attributing the leaks to Robert Saleh. You know, players speaking out of turn in the locker room where you're like, man, you just got here. It's the first practice, and you're telling us how to run the NFL, all of that. So that's where I think, this is a big year. And the team's talented. We know that. If Aaron Rodgers stays healthy, there's no excuses for the Jets or anything like that this year. It's a big year for Saleh.
And, you know, this was an interesting story that I saw last night, and I don't want to spend a lot of time on it. We got the full story at PFT.
Oh, yeah, I saw this, Mike, yeah. You know,
and NFL media, like, one of the realities of a sports league owning its own media conglomerate is you don't cause trouble for the people who own the league, and that's one of the things that I always complain. There isn't true independence. You can't say certain things. And to have NFL media be in the entity that's putting out there this idea that Saleh and owner Woody Johnson had a very animated conversation at the league meetings. I don't think the Jets are happy about that. And I also think that they disagree with the content. That's the double whammy. Not only was it put out there by house media,
they also think it's factually wrong. Mm. So keep an eye on how that plays out. So, but I agree with you. Robert Saleh, it's a given. Everybody's on the hot seat. From Aaron Rodgers to Robert Saleh to Joe Douglas, everybody is on notice this year. It's got to be a lot better than it was last year, or everybody's going to be gone. Okay, I'm wrestling with Mike McCarthy and Nick Sirianni.
Yeah, right, here. Right.
And I think that for Sirianni, it's almost, or for McCarthy, it's almost to the point where it's so obvious.
It's like, duh.
The pressure reduces.
Right.
Like,
it's, yeah. Right. I hear you. I know.
Like I don't have to hide this zit on my forehead. Everybody sees it.
Yeah, right.
I don't have to conceal it. Everybody knows it's there. Now let's go about our business. So I'll go Sirianni because I don't think it's as widely accepted and known that he's kind of on the hot seat this year. We all know McCarthy is firmly there.
Yeah, I don't disagree with you there. I would. I mean, McCarthy would be my next pick, right? But I hear you. It's so in our face. It's such a talking point. There's such a part of the fan base that wants him gone, right? You hear people on TV going, oh, I'd get rid of all of them, do all of that, right? So it is there. It's almost so, you're right, so glaring and in your face that I'm sure he's, I think, numb to it. But the reality is yeah, he is hot, and it's a hot seat. Belichick's lurking like you talked about. And again, I think, you know, expectation levels from the owner are high and all of that. All right. So, yeah, I'm with you. I put Mike McCarthy up there.
All right. Give me your next one. Well, oh, no, you did
I'm
put
taking
Mike McCarthy up.
Right. Yeah, yeah.
You're taking McCarthy.
Yeah.
All right. Just for the reasons we talked about, and maybe it's recency bias from me.
Yeah.
But you got to put Brian Daboll up there, too, because if the other two are thinking about making a change and Bill Belichick would be at the top of their list, this is John Mara's opportunity to bring Bill Belichick in. I don't want to have to deal with that guy twice a year. I want him to be the guy that my rivals have to deal with twice a year. So, you know, the guy who cleared out Ben McAdoo and cleared out Pat Shurmur and cleared out Joe Judge, clear out Brian Daboll and create the path for the guy that they probably would have wanted to hire all along if they could have.
Yeah, I don't disagree with you there. I don't. I mean, it's a big year for Daboll, definitely. You know, you tie that with the things you talked about, the quarterback situation. Do they draft a quarterback? Can he turn Daniel Jones back to the guy we saw 2 years ago? There's a lot there, right? The somewhat, as we look at dysfunction in the coaching staff, I think that's all raised some red flags and put a little more attention on that giant situation. My third
one. Hey, wouldn't it be something?
Yeah.
Hey, whoa.
Right.
To get back to what we were talking about with J.J. McCarthy, if they somehow get McCarthy, wouldn't it be something if Bill Belichick shows up and is coaching a Michigan quarterback again?
It would be amazing, right? And McCarthy's, he in some ways looks like a Brady anyways. He's got like a same smile and face to me. I've honestly thought that when I met J.J. McCarthy. I was like, gosh, he reminds you of a young Tom Brady that way. My last one here, I think Sean Payton's under some pressure. You know, big year in Denver. I think one that I'm going to go here is Dennis Allen, though. I think Dennis Allen's the one I'm going to look at here. It's 2 years. They haven't made the playoff either year. You know, last year certainly were underwhelming in a lot of ways. The defense was not as good as we thought it would be. The offense has this firepower, and yet we're like, damn, they threw another 3-yard pass. Jeez. Dink and dunk, dink and like. So, yeah, it wasn't great. And it was a year where the NFC South was there to be had, and the Saints' talent level was on par or up there with teams like the Tampa Bay Buccaneers or all that. It wasn't that far off. I think this is a big year for them and Dennis Allen. I almost feel like if he doesn't get to the playoffs or do something like that, it's over. It's done.
I have made my choices factoring in the reputation,
I know,
density of ownership,
yeah,
to make change. So I didn't pick Sean McDermott, and I'm not going to pick Sean McDermott because I don't think that Terry Pegula is willing to make the change. I think Terry Pegula is content. Now watch, he'll get fired after this year. But I feel like there is an organizational comfort level and satisfaction with what McDermott does. It goes back to what McDermott said earlier this week. You can't judge success of the organization based upon winning a Super Bowl. We've been successful. And you wonder whether or not that's something that
Terry Pegula has said to him and explaining why he's still with him. So, you know, that took Buffalo off my radar screen. Doug Peterson's on my radar screen because Shad Khan has shown he's willing to throw a guy overboard if he thinks he can go get somebody better. So I think Peterson is in trouble this year. But I'm going to go back to Peyton and the Broncos for a couple of reasons. First of all, and most importantly, the Broncos are owned by the richest ownership group in the NFL.
Yeah.
It will mean nothing to them to buy out $60 million for Sean Payton's final 3 years if they decide they need to move on from Peyton. They won't bat an eye on it. It's a write-off. It's nothing. It's nothing. Walmart makes that much in a day just on the interest on the money that they have in the bank. It's nothing to them. That's one factor. Second factor, the league still doesn't like Sean Payton, and I'm talking about the league office.
Yeah, I got you.
There's still that. And so if they see an opening, there's going to be some comment. This is just my own personal opinion. Don't get too fired up, 345 Park Avenue. I believe that if Payton struggles this year, they're going to find a way. Not that my disclaimer makes it any less inflammatory, frankly, but they're going to find a way to work on Greg Penner to get Sean Payton out of the game because the guy whose name is on the football doesn't like Sean Payton, and that's documented, that's a given, and Payton believes that, I believe. That's another factor. And just, look, at some
the
point,
Russell Wilson
all this
situation,
stuff you're doing,
yeah,
it's got to work.
Yeah.
You know, and I assume that Payton's the one who made the decision and recommended to Greg Penner, instead of taking $35.4 million in dead money this year, let's go ahead and take $53 million because we'll still be fine this year. We can take the 53 this year, and we're going to be a lot better off next year. Let's take the big dead money charge this year, which I think is a mistake, because just because you have the extra cap space doesn't mean you have to use it. You don't have to use it. It's like the Cardinals last year, the way they did the DeAndre Hopkins thing.
Yeah.
They pushed all the cap money to next year. You don't have to use it. You have it. You don't have to use it. It's nice to have it around. So that confused me when they did it, and I just think that all those factors together, how Russell Wilson was handled – And we've already seen Penner fire a coach after 1 year. Now, he didn't hire him, but he still fired a coach after 1 year. I think that Sean Payton is going to be under more pressure than people realize this year. Not that he won't deliver, because maybe he thrives on that. But I think that the pressure is building on him in Denver.
I'm with you there. I mean, Red, I brought his name up too. In fact, I would have picked him if I kind of thought the way you thought there, right? I think you made a good point with, like, the ownership group, because I was kind of like, yeah, Sean Payton's under a lot of pressure, but he's got a big contract and they won't fire him after 2 years. They won't do that. But how you laid it out, and I didn't really think of it that way. You're right. It's an ownership group that will not bat an eye at the money owed at the head coach in this situation. So yeah, it is a big year. We're all going to be looking at it. And of course, when you pay a guy like Sean Payton and all that, teams expect, yeah, quarterback play to be really good, offense to be exciting, team to turn around. Team was better last year. I mean, let's not forget that. It definitely was, right? There was some good. There's some positives to definitely take away. But, yeah, I think there were some things out there that, you know, I'm sure the ownership group would question a little bit.
And I'm not exaggerating. They have literally made $60 million in the time that we have talked about whether or not Sean Payton is under pressure.
Yeah.
It is absolutely nothing to them to pay that money and move on. All right, we move on. When we return, all eyes were on Baton Rouge yesterday for the LSU Pro Day workouts featuring Jaden Daniels and Malik Nabers, among others. We'll discuss that next here on PFT Live.